United Nations Radio presents The Quiet War, starring Miss Helen Hayes. This is the second of two specially recorded broadcasts telling the Korea story. Miss Helen Hayes.
In Korea, there was the war. The relentless war which swept through every corner of the land left not a single Korean untouched. The war raged from Busan to the Yalu River, from the Yellow Sea to the Sea of Japan. And now there is the land, plowed into deeper furrows by the bombs than by untold centuries of tilling. This precious land must be made to yield again its rice and beans and wheat despite the ravages of shells. There are the towns. Of many, we should say, there were the towns. Now blackened ruins, they're haunted by men and women wandering from place to place. And then there are the people. Indomitable, industrious, optimistic, perplexed. A people who, having lived too long beneath an alien yoke, now long for independence. In Korea, a kaleidoscope of the hungry, the homeless, and the haunted. 20 million people, like bits of colored glass, trying to arrange their disjointed lives into a pattern of order, of life. Let's look at the Korean people, one at a time. A first-hand look.
Kim, ask the boys, which of them have no parents? It's no mother or father. Which of them are orphans?
My mother, how many of these
are? Only of
these. Isso? Oh, dear. Our mother is the Taiwan. Really?
Yes.
His home is Daegu.
Well, what is he doing here in Seoul?
서울에 뭐 하러 왔어. 서울에 우리 형 문에서 근데 찾았어, 못 찾았어.
청주서 여기 올라오려면 얼마 있으면 올라오려면.
His brother is here, so he come looking for his brother, but his brother is Chengdu.
Now another impression, second hand.
I found some children looking for their parents, but I found no parents looking for their children.
And third, Home Sweet Home, sung by little ones who have no homes. In a kaleidoscope of the hungry, the homeless, and the haunted. To rebuild the land, the cities, the factories, to make order out of chaos, is a job that needs as many hands as possible. But where to begin? Who are the neediest? Elvin Rees from Wales outlines the picture.
There are probably 125 to 150,000 orphans in Korea. Normally, 150,000 orphans in 20 million people is not too big a burden. But what has happened in Korea is that these children are unabsorbable. The family unit, which is in Asia in particular, is the cushion that has always carried a family over famine, pestilence, earthquake and disaster, seems to have disintegrated. And we face the awful possibility that this many children will have to be brought up in institutions, which is one of the great problems that will face United Nations.
...150,000 orphans. Who looks after them? Who has the time to play mother? First, the United Nations command. The UN forces had a unit which they called UNCAC, the UN Civil Assistance Command Korea. And then, the UN itself. It has an agency, we call it UNCRA, the UN Korean Reconstruction Agency. Along with them are people from many lands, from many agencies and private groups. It is they who rescue countless waifs, wandering and untrusting. One cold day in Seoul during the war, reporter Sonny Fox took his microphone into a jeep and went off with Sergeant Krenza of the Civil Assistance Command to meet Kim, a young Korean boy who knew how to find lost children. This is the actual recording of what happened.
It's 8 a.m. on a dull fall day in Seoul, Korea. I'm driving in a jeep with Sergeant Krenza. attached to the welfare section of UNCAC here in Seoul. The purpose of our mission is to find some of the orphans, some of the young war refugees who are around Seoul, to convince them to come along with us for processing and then to an orphanage where they'll be cared for, fed, clothed, sent to school. We're going along one of the main thoroughfares of Seoul now. Sergeant Kranzer is keeping an eye open here. The railroad terminal now is up ahead of us at the head of the street down which we are now riding. We're at the railroad terminal. Sergeant Kranzer and I are walking out now to the waiting room, to the rail transportation office itself.
Good morning. Is Kim here?
Yeah, we want to pick up one of the two of the orphans here.
Here comes a young boy in a pair of GI coveralls.
How are you this morning, Kim?
Fine, sorry.
Okay, look, I've come down to pick up a few more of your orphans. If you got any, would you help me find a few?
Okay, sorry.
I see Kim had put on a field jacket. Well, now, Kim, where are you taking us now?
Down the yard.
Walking through the rubble of some buildings that are just off the railroad marshaling yards in Seoul. And right before us, we see a group of young boys. One of them's running away. The others are staying. Two of them are running away.
Morning. Morning. How are you, fellas? How are you this morning? Say, what are you eating over there, huh? Well, hey, that looks like apple peelings, huh? Orange peelings.
There are five young boys sitting around. One of them is eating some peelings off a dirty bag with a spoon. And Kim has just brought back one of the boys who ran away.
Kim, ask the boys, which of them have no parents? It's no mother or father. Which of them are orphans?
His home is Daegu.
Well, what is he doing here in Seoul?
His brother is here, so he come looking for his brother, but his brother is Chengdu.
Why would he like to come with us? We'll put him in an orphanage until we locate his brother. Hey, wait a minute. He looks sick more than anything else. Ask him if he feels all right.
No, Pujano.
His eyes is hurt.
Well, he's not well. He should go to a hospital or something. He shouldn't be here like that. Kim, ask him this. Tell him that I do not want to take him to one of the orphanages unless he wants to go, because they will care for him. Here, this way, he may die in the next few days. The way he's living, he will be taken care of. Look at those clothes he has on. At least he'll get clean clothes and he'll get some place to sleep and blankets and some food. And his eyes will be taken care of also. All right, well, let's go.
Kim, while we're walking back, I want to ask you, why do you work so hard at trying to get these boys to go with the sergeant?
I think it's good he's going to orphanage.
Do you think that the orphanages are doing a good job for these boys?
Sure.
Back into the jeep they went, Fox, Krenzer, Kim, and the three orphans they had in tow, and off to the United Nations Civil Administration Reception Center. On arrival, the boys line up in the office of an Indian social affairs officer, Mr. Mahindra. What do they look like?
One boy is about 4.5 feet tall, close-cropped head. He's wearing some kind of a cloth jacket, baggy, looks like cut-down GI fatigues, an undershirt, no shoes. The boy in the center is the shortest and youngest one of the group, as I would judge. His hair is close-cropped. His face is incredibly dirty. He's wearing a filthy shirt. Around his neck is tied a small bag in which he, I suppose, put whatever scraps of food he was able to get. The third boy is the tallest of the group. His face is slightly cleaner. He is wearing no shoes. These are the three orphans as they stand here at 8:30 in the morning in the office of the Social Welfare Group here working with UNCOC and Seoul.
UNCOC, the UN Civil Assistance Command, Korea. Mr. Mahindra has a few questions.
What's your name? I'm asking, what's his name?
Irim bonya?
Gilsu.
Gilsu? Seungun?
Jogaya.
Ah, Jogilsu.
Hejonghwa.
Hejonghwa.
Shimhyuntaek.
Shimhyuntaek. How old are they? 너 열두 살 알고 있지?
열두
살이요. 열두 살.
너
열두 살?
네.
열두 살 그랬지?
네.
12 years? 열 몇 살? 12 years, 13 years old. Mr. Chang asked, who was giving them the food every day? 그럼 너 밥은 어떻게 입대까지 얻어 먹고 왔니?
안 얻어 먹었어요.
응?
누가,
네,
누가 주문 먹고 이렇게 땅에서 주워 먹고.
They couldn't get to any food, so for, unless they get some food from somebody.
When is the last time they had good meal? How long did you eat? How long
did you eat?
He got the breakfast yesterday. That will be the last one.
Okay, Mr. Chang, we will take care of them. They will give him some medical checkup and shots. And after that, we'll put them in the orphanages. We got everything to eat there. They'll have nice place to sleep, nice food to eat.
On the third floor of the orphanage, in the medical room, a doctor lends a hand.
Dr. Ingrid Turlson is examining the three orphans preparatory to having them leave from here to another processing point. Dr. Turlson is from Denmark, and she is a public health officer with UNCAC. She's now unbuttoning the jacket of the 14-year-old boy, feeling his glands and looking at his backs of his hands, his fingers, to see whether there are any particularly obvious diseases. She's feeling his abdomen now. How do they look to you, Dr. Toulson?
I think they look completely healthy.
Really? In spite of all their hardships?
Oh, yes. They are able to take care of themselves and get on their feet.
You think a couple of baths, perhaps, and some good meals and clothing might help them out and shape them up?
I think a bath would help them extremely.
A bath, some food, some clothing, and most of all, some human kindness to help heal this horror that children cannot understand. The question is, does it help? Kim said the orphanages were good. Are they? UN reporter Brian Meredith, a Canadian, recorded his answer in a makeshift radio studio high on a hill in Busan.
I watched a group of orphans come out and greet the Korean lady who had been the guardian angel of their orphanage, who had just returned from abroad to find her own home emptied, her orphanage largely destroyed, and her own son dead, shot by the enemy. The orphans were in rags, and they had been sheltering in what had been one of the outbuildings of their institution. They came out one by one. They bowed solemnly with their hands clasped before them, and they moved slowly and unsmilingly, for they were pitifully close to starvation. It's strange and frightening even meeting children who are listless and silent, and I'm glad to say that when I saw them again a few weeks later, they were lively and smiling, for they had much more food inside them, and life, after a fashion, was beginning again.
There's a challenge for the world to make their lives begin again. Those children might have been ours, and in a UN sense, they are. In Korea, where war has taken over, disease rides hard on the heels of hunger. Those hospitals and clinics, still intact, are too few to meet the emergency. So the United Nations World Health Organization steps in to attack typhus and smallpox, to wage the quiet war against disease. In Korea, Dr. Faisal L. Ard of Syria talks the way doctors talk, but tells us something we hadn't known.
Yeah, when we first came up there, you see, we tried to figure out how much cases are in a month, say, in typhus or typhoid or smallpox. We were amazed to find out that they had last year in March some 35,000 cases of typhus in a month, something like 15,000 cases of smallpox. So we started a mass immunization program, which called for to immunize as many people as possible. And by the end of this program, we succeeded to immunize some 18 million people against typhoid, 16 against typhus, 15 million against smallpox. The result was that this incidence dropped from 35,000 to 57.
Dr. Ard, have you found that it's been difficult at all working with all these other nationalities who are members of your UNCOC teams?
Oh, no, not at all. You have, for instance, the doctor is Australian. The sanitary engineer is a Greek. The welfare officer is a Scotchman. The supply officer is French. The welfare officer is a Peruvian. It's a kind of the best proof that the people can understand each other if they understand their own problem.
And they can understand their own problems better if they can see the plight of others. The United Nations Korean Reconstruction Agency has that job to do. Teams of world health doctors have added up Korea's medical needs and pinpointed a plan to help 20 million Korean people. How? Ask Dr. Howard Rusk, the world-renowned consultant on the rehabilitation of the crippled. Invite him to the UN microphone and get him started on the subject of amputees.
They estimate that there are about 10,000 amputees, rocks from the army, and another 10 in civilian life. If it's accurate, then that's as many amputees as the United States suffered. Marines, Navy, Army, Air Force in World War II. About 18 months ago, the United States Army set up a small artificial eye and limb unit in a place called Tongnae near Busan. A year ago, they were making 20 legs a month. Now they're making about 125. It's still only a drop in the bucket, and while they have a place to make legs, there's no training for these people, which, being in rehabilitation, I think is just as important as the artificial leg. So I'm sending over from our institute down at New York University, Bellevue, three of our top therapists who are leaving next week. A nurse who's especially trained in rehabilitation, an occupational therapist, and a physical therapist. And we're also furnishing certain supplies for them. And I've told my girls, they each are going for a year, that I expect them, each one, to train a minimum of five Korean girls to do the basic training needs for these amputees.
A few orderly patterns have emerged from our kaleidoscope. Long-range programs for the future health of a country are important, if you live to see the day. But action is needed for now, and action it is in the front lines of this quiet war, or rather at an airstrip in Korea where planes are waiting to take off on a very special mission. Reporter Fox asks American Lieutenant Royce Reed what we want to know.
Lieutenant Reed, what is this flight's mission?
The first epidemiological flight is concerned with insect and rodent control and survey work throughout Korea and the technical supervision of the aerial spray program, which is now in operation.
The pilots listen to the briefing from Lieutenant Reed.
The targets you'll be covering this afternoon will be the Korean city of Suwon. We're spraying the city as a result of a request that came in from UNCAC, Preventive Medicine Section. They've had some cases of Japanese bee encephalitis reported down in the area, and they think that aerial spray will be the emergency means of controlling mosquito breeding in the area. The coordinates of the city is Charlie Sugar 2528. You'll be taking off at approximately 1500 this afternoon, and you should be able to target within approximately 15 minutes. We're going to go ahead and spray the city with a whole load of insecticide. You'll be making your passes north to south as we have a prevailing wind from the east this afternoon of approximately 5 knots with a temperature of 62 degrees, which should be ideal.
It isn't long before this operation gets a nickname, Flit Flight. Did the men go for it?
Lieutenant Hale, you operate one of those two-motored planes, is that right?
That's right. About the first time I heard of this program, I walked into squadron operations and they asked me would I like to go spraying. Well, here I am. It's a lot of fun. It's a very interesting duty, and I think we're doing a lot of good.
Lieutenant Hale hails from the USA. Other men from other lands fight the quiet war with him.
I'm a doctor from Esbjerg in Denmark. I have the responsibility of supervising a BCG vaccination program against tuberculosis among children in Korea, combined with a training program of Korean doctors and nurses in special techniques.
John Scully of Glasgow, Scotland speaking. I assist in the rehabilitation of the sanitary services in Korea. We run the garbage trucks for the capital city, supervise insect, rodent, and infectious disease control.
Men from many lands are there to help. From UNCRA and UNESCO, Professor Cottrell of Ohio State University, USA. Dr. Benner of the University of Illinois, USA. Monsieur le Professeur Grosbois of France. Mr. Vitaliano Bernardino of the Philippines. These are some of the men who are moving ahead to get Korea's schools in shape again. And then...
My name is Gyan Prakash Mohinder. I come from a town in East Punjab, northern part of India. I am welfare officer with UN Civil Affairs Command. My duties are essentially concerned with distribution and supervision of the relief supplies in consultation with local government authorities.
The local government authorities have plenty of problems, not the least of which is how to get enough food for the Korean people. The fields, the farms, the paddies which supply the rice are almost all gone. One of the experts assigned to help out is Raymond D. Vickery of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Mr. Vickery, how does a country get so close to starvation?
First of all, there was a terrific increase in population. About 1.5 million Koreans were brought back from other countries. Up near 1 million people evidently didn't like the communist regime in North Korea, and they fled across the 38th parallel.
You never realized before what a privilege it is to just have enough to eat. Mr. Glenn Leet, who has done reconstruction work for the UN from Greece to Korea, starts a story you wish he hadn't begun.
Once there was a Korean who wanted to have a big celebration on his 60th birthday, and he was very poor, so he started saving. He didn't eat Monday, and he didn't eat Tuesday, or Wednesday, or Thursday, or Friday, and on Saturday he could have had a wonderful feast, except he died of starvation. It made me realize that the spirit is there, but unless they can have a little food in their stomach, they just can't go on and make the progress or the improvements that are so necessary and so vital.
We keep turning our Korean kaleidoscope, and at each turn we see new difficulties. But we also see the pattern of international action. Ask Mr. J. Donald Kingsley, who waged a quiet battle of his own as agent general in Korea when he organized the UN Reconstruction Agency.
The free world has begun to learn some important lessons during the last 3 years. Probably the most important lesson has been that in resistance against the type of aggression we have met there, and which remains a threat throughout much of the world, military power, while vital, is only a partial defense, and that both successful resistance and lasting peace depend upon the effective use of democracy's great resources. In practical terms, this means, for one thing, fulfillment of the free world's commitments. This has taken positive form in Korea as a result of General Clark's statesmanlike decision to permit UNCRA to launch a really significant reconstruction program. That program is now in high gear, and from personal knowledge, I can tell you that it is already having a profound and far-reaching effect on the morale of the Korean people.
Who taught a lot on the subject of how to help the helpless, directs the work of UNCRA. He is General John B. Coulter of the United States.
The free world will not be willing to turn its back on the Korean people it has now freed from the threat of tyranny. They have suffered as few people have suffered in all of history. They have been slain, wounded, starved, put to flight, widowed, and orphaned. Their country has suffered damage that staggers the imagination. Despite the intelligence, industry, and patriotism of the Koreans, the task of putting their country back on its feet is impossible of achievement without the help of the free nations and of the men and women of goodwill everywhere.
The UN needs no monument in Korea. The graves, the lives, and the work that still goes on are memorial enough, reminder enough to those of short memory. But there is one building that exists in Korea today which can hardly be forgotten by those who have seen it. It is a church built by army drivers from the 231st Truck Battalion of the United States. A church not exclusively for one denomination or one kind of worshiper. In it, any man can pause and pray or meditate. In the church of the 231st Truck Battalion, the men have reflected on the past, the present, and the future. This church still stands, its doors open to all, a symbol of man's hope to live at peace with man. Howard Rusk, who spoke to us before, once said,
"What happens in Korea depends on you as a world citizen and on those of us who are world veterans. Here are our allies who have given the best of themselves and their country. Anything we give to Korea will not be a gift. It will be a little payment on a debt that we cannot pay in kind, but only in substance."
A little payment on a debt that we cannot pay in kind, but only in substance. Which is why the songs, the sounds, and the voices you've been listening to with me should not be forgotten.
He didn't eat Monday, and he didn't eat Tuesday, or Wednesday, or Thursday, or Friday, and on Saturday he could have had a wonderful feast, except he died of starvation.
The targets you'll be covering this afternoon will be the Korean city of Suwon.
Doctor is Australian. The sanitary engineer is a Greek. The welfare officer is a Scotchman. The supply officer is French.
What's your name? I'm asking, what's his name?
Irimonya.
Jisoo.
Jisoo? Soon.
I found some children looking for their parents, but I found no parents looking for their children.
This is why men from many nations have gathered to help the Korean people, and why the United Nations continues to wage the quiet war.
You have just heard Miss Helen Hayes in The Quiet War, the second of two specially recorded chapters of The Korea Story, produced by United Nations Radio. The Quiet War featured actual recordings from UN archives. Irving Berenson wrote the text, the entire production by Gerald Keane of United Nations Radio.